When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In 1973, the New York City Police Department created a hostage negotiation team.
He's not up against a gun. He's up against a man's mind.
When you're defusing a human bomb, it's the same as when you're taking apart a real bomb. If you skip a step, it's going to blow up right in your face.
Talk to Me tells the high-stakes true story of the world's first hostage negotiation team. It changed policing forever. Talk to Me.
You know, I got to tell you, I have so many garbage apps on my phone, I never know where to look for stuff. And recently, I decided to clean house. All the junk and clutter gone. This leaves me with my most cherished apps. You know, the ones that can do it all. Like my Live One app. Music, events, news, podcasts, comedy. Oh, and actual musical stations curated by humans, not those robots hanging out on Bezos' yacht. All this on one tiny little place on my phone. I've become such a fan of the app, we here at the Adam Carolla Show will give you 3 months free. Jump on to liveone.com/Carolla to lock in your deal today. And with inflation at an all-time high, this is a huge savings. liveone.com/Carolla for 3 months plus for free. No ads. Do you own? Do you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Well, Jay Leno's joined us in studio. Jay Leno's Garage, of course. Never miss an episode of that. You can catch it all on his YouTube channel, Jay Leno's Garage, and shoot him a tweet at Jay Leno as well. Good to see you again, my friend.
Good to see you. Good to see you. Yeah, nice to be back.
So first things first, an outpouring of well-wishers after your accident.
Yeah, people have been very nice. I thought it'd be like, I hope you die, Leno. No, we didn't get any of that. Actually, everybody's very nice.
I think the president reached out to you.
Yeah, president called a couple of times. Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, I mean, they had to. I mean, everyone says, well, you know, you want to die, but you want to experience your funeral because right. You want to see all those people saying all those nice things.
I've never said that, but yeah, it was nice to see. Yes.
But
yes,
this was a nice test run.
A nice test run. Yeah, it was great. It was great. It's actually good. It was actually good.
I was home watching all the entertainment shows and the news feeds and everything, and it was as if you were a beloved American character.
Well, the funny thing, I always like Entertainment Tonight because when someone is sick or injured or killed, they always play the song slower.
Yes.
Jay Leno today. Yeah, it's my favorite.
Yeah, my favorite is when the guy from TMZ who talks like a cartoon character gets sort of somber now.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah,
he was talking about Lindsay Lohan being drunk 10 seconds ago, but now we're entering
my favorite Harvey Levin story. You know, he's the TMZ guy. He used to be the
courtroom guy.
You know, but he used to be on ABC News at 11 o'clock. He was their, Joel Grover, what do they call him there?
Yeah, it was like consumer commander or something.
So one day I'm sitting at home and I meet my buzzer. I look on the camera. Oh, it's Harvey Levin, you know? He goes, hello, is this the home of Jay Leno? I go, well, this is Mr. Leno's housekeeper, Mrs. Hudson. How can I help you? He goes, we're doing a story on celebrities who waste water. And Mr. Leno's water bill is higher than normal. I said, oh, Mr. Leno's very thrifty about water. He's very careful, and he makes sure all the faucets are working properly. And now we did have a leaky sprinkler system that may have contributed to it. Is Mr. Leno there? No, Mr. Leno's not here, but he gave me strict instructions. You know, so Harvey continued to ask me these questions, right? So I go, well, thank you very much, right? So that night, I'm going to watch. So I'm watching ABC News. Like, Harvey, I'm outside the home of Jay Leno. He puts the mic next to the speaker box, and you hear, oh, Mr. Leno is very thrifty about saving. And it says, Mrs. Hudson, voice of Mrs. Hudson, Jay Leno's housekeeper. So when I called him back, and I go, you know, Harvey, that was me. I don't have a housekeeper. And that's very funny.
I'd never heard that one before. So Jay showed me pictures at the Malibu Mart several days back, which I would just describe as a crime scene and gory and a mafia hit where they were trying to send a message.
The Taglias.
The pictures of your face that were just 2 weeks earlier from the time.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
We did that in 8 days, 9 days. I mean, just unbelievable.
So how much time in the hyperbaric chamber?
About 4 hours a day.
And how much Chick-fil-A could you consume from inside the hospital?
That's what you had to do.
I had to go there.
It's a wonderful hospital. The food is hospital food. But no, they were actually very good at the. Because what happened was I was working on this steam car, and the steam car is an open flame because you have a pilot.
Yeah. And well, set the table. What day is it? What time is
it? It's Saturday about 12:30. My friend Dave is there. I said, shoot me a little pressure through the fuel line so we can clear this line, you know? Okay. So it's nothing. I said, and all of a sudden, choof, I just get a face full of gas, you know, like maybe a quart. I go, pah! And I just turn my head and I see, woof! And, oh boy, because I went, Dave, I'm on fire. And he went, what? Don't get around. I go, Dave, I'm on fire. Look at me. So he looked at me and he pulled me out. And then he jumped on me and we extinguished it. By that time, my face was pretty burned. So I said, well, let me go to the bathroom. So I go to the bathroom, I put cold water. I go, it doesn't look that bad, you know. And he says, no, we got to call paramedics. I said, I don't want to bother. Okay. So Burbank Fire comes over and they go, oh, yeah, this is pretty bad. Really? Okay. I'm at Flappers tonight. We can't do a show. Okay. So they take me to St. John's. And then St. John says, no, you got to go to the burn center. Okay. So I go back to my garage and I drive out to the burn center.
You drove yourself?
I drove myself out to the burn center. And I go in, I go, I am burned. Okay, we got to admit you right now. I go, well, my wife doesn't know anything about this. Can I go home? No, you can't go home first. I go, guys, I got to go home first and then I'll come back. So I went home and I spent the night at home.
You spent the first night at home?
Yeah, and then that morning I drove to the burn center and checked myself in and take it from there.
It's interesting. I mean, I'll say it so you don't have to, but you have a kind of stoicism, but it's not stoicism of literature. It's sort of like you think about other people first. Like your first thought is, oh, I told Flappers I was doing 20 minutes tonight.
I was doing an hour and a half, but yeah, okay.
I'm trying to make you more stoic.
Yeah, okay.
So your first is like, I have this obligation.
Well, it didn't seem that bad to me because obviously I can't see my
Right, but that's
own face.
Part of the kind of stoicism. You know, a lot of people would have broken down, started crying and yelling at somebody.
No, nothing worse than whiny celebrities.
I agree.
Believe me, people love to see rich people set on fire. There's something in, you know, it's the kind of thing where you make jokes about it. If you start going, oh, woe is me and how painful, people go, shut up.
But your next thought is about your wife and it's going to scare her, it's going to worry her.
Right, right.
And then you have this thing that I have too, which is I'll just go home. Right. Once I can, if I can sleep in my own bed, I'll be fine.
Exactly.
Right. So I can't. Okay, let me backtrack for a second. You were sprayed with gasoline.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it immediately fire after that, or was there a beat or two of...
millisecond.
And then fire.
And I turned my head, and I saw the flame. So I quickly closed my eyes, and I held my breath, because I remember Niki Lauda. Remember Niki Lauda got in the fire, and what did... He breathed in, he scorched his lungs.
Right.
So I said, okay, just I'm not a panicky person, so I just said, that's it, Dave, I'm on fire. Dave, I'm on fire. And he pulled me out. And then it was okay.
You were under the car.
I was under the car. He pulled me out, yeah.
And do I know Dave, by the way?
Dave Kalacki, the big guy, transmission guy. best Allison transmission guy you're going to find,
Well, I was looking for a new Allison guy, so
yeah, well, there you go. Dave's the guy to do it.
Yeah, not the guy to kindle the hearth at home, perhaps, but if you have an Allison...
No, good guy, if you catch on fire, you want to have Dave around. Yeah.
But if you have an Allison
transmission... I probably would have lost his eye if it wasn't for Dave.
Really?
Yeah. Because he put his hand over my face, and my face is on fire, so that burned his whole arm. So he got a bad burn also.
So... I thought the reports were an ambulance picked you up, the fire department showed up, but you drove yourself.
No, the ambulance, the fire department with the ambulance came to the garage, and they took me to St. Joe's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then I drove myself after that.
You drove yourself back home.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did they let you leave St. Joe's?
Well, you can't make somebody stay if they don't want to stay. I said, guys, I'll be back, I promise.
But didn't they say it could get worse or there could be some scarring or some issues or infection?
Yeah, I guess there was some talk of that. But it was all right. It turned out to be all right.
And when you went home, then were you in exquisite pain? Because you burn your pinky and it'll keep you up at night.
Yeah, it's – it's tricky. As I tell people, it's better than a broken leg. At least I'm not hobbling around. I mean, pain you can deal with, you know. And you go, okay, just calm down, and it was okay. It was okay. I mean, once I got to the burn center, and I started treatment, it was actually your face is just wrapped in like a helmet for like 9 days, and you're in the same room for 9 or 10 days. That'll drive you a little crazy, but they were wonderful. It's a wonderful hospital. It's probably the best burn center in the country, actually.
What do they physically do to get you looking certainly – well, I don't want to say certainly, but a little bit younger than you looked before the burn?
The fact that I have smooth skin, pouty lips, and a tight butt has nothing to do with the fire. That was purely coincidental at the hospital.
Well, it looks like you've had
surgery.
A peel. Is a women pay
a lot
of
money
for a peel.
I showed you that picture where they take a circular saw. It's like the size of your hand. They put it on your face, and they literally remove your face and put new skin in.
Where do they get the skin?
You know, it's taken from dead comics. Like this whole arm, this is all red buttons.
This
whole arm is red buttons, yeah. This is all red buttons. I got a little Shandling, some John Panette, a little bit of
Because
they want to make sure the DNA takes – it's comic to comic, you know.
Yeah, John Panette had a lot of extra skin to go around.
He did.
God rest his soul.
Yeah, we were going to make a car cover of what we had left.
Winnebago.
Yeah.
So you're in the hospital now, which probably drove you nuts because you're one of these people that wants to be with your stuff. You want to go do your work, so on and so
forth. You know,
it's
funny. I thought it would be, but it wasn't that bad. You know, it's like during COVID. I never thought I would take like 6 months off and just sit. Mm-hmm. But then I realized nobody else is working either. So it's not like, you know, you're in a competitive business, and it's usually if you're sitting, somebody else is working.
Right.
But nobody is working. So, you know, I was fortunate these things happened near the end of my career, not the beginning. So you can kind of deal with it, you know, makes it a little easier.
Did you have that sort of I guess there's two types. I don't know. Some comedians just want to go out and do comedy for the sake of comedy, and then others are a little more competitive. Like you're thinking, what are my contemporaries doing? Oh, he got a shot on The Tonight Show.
No, I never thought that. You know, to me, you can't think. You know, I was lucky. When I started in Boston, for a year, I was the only comedian I knew. There really weren't any. It's not like today where everybody wants to be a comic. When you went to the clubs – They weren't clubs. They were nightclubs. And they usually had like Bud Friedman always used to say, three singers and then you. Because he had all – it was all Broadway singers. And comedians were fairly rare. So really – so consequently, I didn't really feel competitive. You know, I'd watch comics on TV. And then when they were coming to Boston, I'd contact them and say, you know, I'm a comic. You guys should stay at my house. That's how I met Billy Crystal. That's how I met Rich Lewis. That's how I met Freddie Prinze, all those – everybody stayed at my place when they played like the Playboy Club in Boston, you know. So I got to be friends. But I never judged my success against other comedians. I would see new people come in. They get up at the Improv, and they get a few laughs because they're new. And then they're following Robin Williams and Letterman and Rob – just all the comics. And they would get all depressed. And they go, well, you can't just go at your own pace. You can't judge yourself by somebody else.
So, you know, I was thinking about your reaction to being set on fire, and then always thinking about your reaction in the Hemi under glass, wheeling funny car where you rolled over and seemed to sort of, you're immediately concerned about the driver and you sort of were non-frazzled by it. And we may share this. Do you have a kind of a detuned wiring in that? And somebody was just telling me about a story about, you know, you're driving down the or you're walking down the street and a car backfires and a large percent of people jump. But then there's some people
that
don't
jump. You know why they
jump?
Because they think it's 1949. Because cars haven't backfired since about 1949. That's my favorite thing in L.A. when I heard. You know, when I heard it, I thought it was firecrackers. First of all, gunfire is way more prevalent in L.A. than firecrackers.
I know.
Firecrackers you hear once a year.
Yeah.
Gunfire you hear every day.
And so it's February.
Oh, I thought it was firecrackers. Really? Really?
I know. It's so sad. But would you tend to jump? Are you wired that way?
I'm not a jump guy. In fact, I have a funny video. I was sitting on a steam car. My friend Dave was doing something. And it just – a loud boom, like, boom! Just blew all the insulation. And you see my friend Jimmy just running at 100 miles an hour away from the car. And I was sitting on the car because once it goes off, there's nothing you can do.
Right. So you just have a kind of a – you're kind of detuned that way.
Well, I don't know. I'm just not a panicky person.
Right. But it's not just as it pertains to being set on fire or rolling a funny car. It's a kind of a way of life for you.
Well, I don't know if it's a way. I don't think of it as a way of life.
Well, I don't mean it's all you think about. What I'm saying is you. There's some people, if they came home and the pool had a big crack in it, and drain down the hill or something, they start screaming, my God, what's going on? You know,
I know those people.
You wouldn't have, you wouldn't have that reaction.
No.
And do you think that translates into going out on stage, or at least did early? A lot of people are bundles of nerves or up in their head. You've always been a very relaxed performer. Was it always
that
way?
Well, I'm a relaxed performer because I realize nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you do a bad show, I know people, I did a good show. I can never go back there. You can go back tomorrow because nobody remembers you. You didn't get a laugh.
Right.
Don't worry about it. It's if you were invisible. If you were killed and blown the room out, they'd wonder. You know?
Right.
And that's sort of my attitude with
it. Yeah. All right. Well, maybe I'm digging too deep.
I don't know. I'm not very deep. So, yeah. I mean, it's pretty simple. I just... you know, the idea is if you make jokes about it, you have more fun with it. Nobody wants to see a rich guy whining and complaining because most people have their own problem. You know, I grew up in a small town. And when you grow up in a small town, we weren't poor, certainly, but we weren't wealthy. But you grow up with that attitude of rich people don't have any problems.
Mm-hmm.
If you got money, it solves every problem.
Right.
To a certain extent, it does. And to a certain extent, it doesn't. But for a lot of people who don't have money, it does. All their problems will be solved for an extra 100 grand a year or whatever it might be. You know, so the fact if something happens to you, they got their own problems to worry about. So you make fun of your problems or your situation so they can at least have a laugh at your expense about it. You know?
So you spend your first night at home in your bed.
Yeah.
Is your wife horrified? Is she telling you need to go into the hospital?
Yeah, because my face is now stuck to the pillow. Okay, so I'm peeling that off.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you the funniest one like that. One day I'm asleep. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I put my hand, and my hand's all wet. And I go, what's that? I go, did I wet the bed? How old am I? So I turn on the light and pull on the cover, and the whole bed is covered with blood. And I go, okay, what's going on? And I look at my leg, and a vein popped out. And it's going, it's like
spraying blood.
It's just spraying blood everywhere. Oh, jeez. So I grab a sock, and I tie it around it, right? Because we got white carpets. That's all I'm using. So I'm trying to get – I said, I got to get to the bathroom without ruining the carpet. So I tie the sock around. So I go to the bathroom. I stick my foot in the toilet trying to figure out what's going on here. And I wipe it off. And by this time, my wife wakes up. I'm gone, and – And the whole
covered with blood.
Is covered with blood. And now she's going, I'm in here, honey. It's fine. Who attacked? Nobody attacked me. And I somehow a vein had just burst in my leg. And, I mean, I went to the doctor the next day and I got it taken care of. But, yeah, it was the same kind of thing. It wasn't a panicky situation. It was just, oh, what's going on, you know.
But you looked a fright, as they say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And did you just go to bed that night?
Well, when I tied it off,
I don't mean the vein. I'm sorry. I'm back to your face at that at that point.
Yeah, I went to bed. I went to bed and I woke up next morning and my face was kind of stuck to the pillow. I'm like peeling it up because I said, okay. I said, honey, I'm going to the hospital. You know, I'll have one of the guys get you in. And we brought another bed in for her and she stayed with me while I was there.
That's sweet.
Yeah, it was great. We had a fun time.
You guys been married since 1980?
Yeah, 43 years.
Very un-Hollywood, very un-comedian-like of you.
Not really. I find comedians either get married a long time or it's just bouncing off the walls. But for I think for most part, Rickles was married a long time. Who else? Just a lot of comedians. Billy Crystal.
John Panette.
Was Panette married?
I don't know.
No, but call I mean, back. So no, I don't think it's any more. I think comedians actually stay married longer than other people in show business.
Mm-hmm. And certainly probably more than actors, directors, writers.
You know, my wife is always a good audience. I can try jokes out and she gets it and thinks it's funny. You know, the idea, you have to marry one that's funny. You know, I mean, I remember it was a couple months ago, it's the middle of the night, my wife tapping me on the shoulder. She goes, honey, I go, what? I love you. I said, you're having a nightmare. Go back to bed. And she thought that was like the funniest thing. I mean, she just thought that was the funniest thing. And it just made me laugh.
You know? Are you romantic? Do you celebrate anniversaries?
Yeah,
do you buy jewelry?
Just had my anniversary. No, I've bought her all the jewelry. There's no new jewelry in the world left to get her. So we usually, she works a lot with women in Afghanistan and stuff like that. So I gave her, scholarships for a bunch of girls. She would find these girls in Afghanistan and we'd send them to college. You know.
How'd you guys meet?
She's in the audience. I've been... I live with five women in my life, and all of them were born on the same day.
Really?
And when I met Mavis, I just said, hey, can I ask you when you're born? She said, September 5th. I said, okay. And I realized, okay, that I must have a type. Yeah.
I don't want to get weird, but we're counting your mom?
No, I didn't marry my mom.
Well, you said lived with, so.
No. Well, I mean, I didn't live with my mom that
way. I should have explained a sexual relationship.
I forget, we're in incestuous Hollywood.
Lived with five women before you got married?
Well, over the course of years, you know.
But you weren't, they weren't old, you know, 43 years
I was
ago.
30 when I got married.
Yeah, I'm just saying that's five women. Is it?
Yeah, every couple of years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you a bit of a ladies' man back then?
No, not at all.
But five women all born on the same.
They just happened to, you know, I'll tell you a funny thing. One day I had Kathy Geiswhite. Remember her? Mm-hmm. She drew Kathy the comic strip.
Yeah, Kathy the comic strip.
And I'm talking to her, you know, and I said during the break, look, I'm not hitting on you. Please don't take this the wrong way. But I wrote something down on a piece of paper. For some reason, I'm attracted to a woman born on this day. Just look at the paper and see, is that your birthday? And she went, that is my birthday. I said, okay. Okay, that's all. I said, this doesn't go any further. I'm not going to call you. I'm not going to stop. I was just because I felt an attraction. I don't know why that was. It just made me laugh. I just thought, okay, it's one of those things that is whatever it is.
So you could feel, this is really kind of interesting. So five women all born on the same date and
well, I went with other women too, but I mean, those were ones that were kind of serious, you know?
Right? And then this is after you're married at this point. You see Kathy,
yeah,
but you have a feeling like,
well, I found us being flirtatious with her during the interview,
mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm just curious, and she knew how to do it back, being a sort of a comedian herself, in a cartoon vein, of course. She gets jokes, and I just remember, you know, sort of having fun, and she was laughing, and I went, oh, this is You know, sometimes a woman's laughing at your jokes, and you know she's not forcing it. You know, it's all real. You go, oh, it's kind of fun, especially if you're a comic. You know, so that, yeah.
So we're all over the place. But in the hospital, mm-hmm. are they surprised at the results they've had with you as quickly as they've had with you? Or are you a bit of an outlier? Because you really look
flawless right now.
Pretty
quickly. And I don't take any pain medication. I refuse to do any of that.
Why?
Well, the pain is there for a reason. You know, I mean, you know, my favorite, there's some commercial on TV. I don't know what the product is. A guy's at the fair and he eats 6 hot dogs. You see him.
Right.
And then
right.
he's like, they show him, oh, right. he's at home and he's sick. Oh, honey, take this. And he takes 2 of the pills. And then the end of the commercial, he's at the fair eating 6 hot dogs. Go, what are you doing? It's not to teach you how to eat more hot dogs. It's telling you you're eating. Stop eating the hot dogs. That's what the problem is. So to me, I just figured it was just better to live with the pain. So, okay, this is as bad as it's going to get. Let's just see how. Okay, this is not that. I don't need to take anything. You know, I'm just not that. I don't know. I mean, when I first came to town, I went to. I was broke. I had no money. And I went down to the unemployment office. Come and said that you can get money there, you know.
What year is this?
Oh, this is 71, maybe 72. And the woman said, did you look for work this week? And I looked at her. I said, oh, no, not hard enough. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. And I couldn't bring myself to go back. And I'm proud I didn't go back. I didn't take the money. I just felt better.
Yeah, I agree with you, especially on the guy and his overconsumption of hot dogs. And I agree with you, your body's kind of telling you something.
Yeah, yeah.
But once...
But it does make you stronger, doesn't it?
Once you're sprayed, yeah.
It does make you stronger. I mean, when your face is burned and then it begins to tighten, you just feel the strength coming back again. And it's kind of a cool... I mean, I don't know. Are you most alive right before you think you're going to die? Is that probably true? Is there anything to that? You know, it kind of makes you appreciate, oh, okay, you know.
Well, you said you weren't that deep 5 minutes ago, but I think you just went to the deep end, Jay.
No, this is...
But I get many people who are recovering addicts, and they go, I can't go there. And then... I agree with you what you say about the hot dog, but the being sprayed in the face with gas and sort of not your own fault, I don't know if there's lessons to be learned from it, but you're in the hospital. I think most people would take the Vicodin at that point.
I don't know. I consider a personal victory not to.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't have to. I mean, obviously, if the pain had been unbearable – then I might have done it.
Well, I think it may have been unbearable to some people.
Well, that's possible. I mean, I do have a pretty high pain threshold, but that's okay. So, but I mean, there are other things. If you had asked me to spell chrysanthemum, I would have taken it for that because right. I'm dyslexic and I can't spell. But no, not for this. And my attitude was, look, at least it's not a broken leg. Then I'd be hobbling for 12 weeks. This way, I'm going to be riding motorcycles next week. I'll be fine, you know.
Did you get diagnosed with dyslexia much later in life? Wasn't when you were young, was it?
No. When I was a kid, this was a cure for dyslexia. Smarten up.
Right.
Smarten up. Just get whacked in the face, you know. I mean, I never heard the word till I was like 19. Oh, that's – I just assumed, okay, I just kind of turned things around a little bit. So I didn't use it as a crutch or anything. It just, you know.
I was considered dyslexic as well, except for I'm not. I just never learned to read or write.
Oh, yeah, that's
that'll slow your roll a little bit scholastically as well. But I also kind of wonder if that's where the mechanical stuff comes in, because I didn't want to read and I didn't want to write and I didn't want to sit and do any of that. I wanted to get my hands onto something.
Right.
And I didn't know if it was the inability to read that pushed me toward the garage or the garage was just beckoning.
Well, I was very lucky. I had, you know, I came from a small town where you had career teachers. I mean, here in LA, I meet a lot of teachers that are teaching while they're finishing the screenplay or whatever it might be, you know. But I remember I had an English teacher, Mrs. Hawks, and she, one day she stopped me in the hall and she said, come here, Leno. I always see you screwing around in class and telling jokes. And she said, you know, instead of writing a paper for my English class, why don't you give a talk? You give it like a 10-minute talk on something. And I said, oh, okay. So for the first time in my life, I actually went home and enjoyed doing homework. You know, I practiced this, you know, like a routine. Not very good, but okay. And I gave the talk. Oh, I got an A. And my mother was thrilled. I never got an A. And it was like, oh. And she said, you know, you ever think about being maybe a comedy writer or a comedian? I went, oh, no, not really. I mean, we live in Andover, Massachusetts. There's no place to be a comedian. She said, well, you should think about that, you know. And she really gave me the impetus for that, you know. She died very young of breast cancer, and we set up a scholarship in her name and stuff like that. But I was just very fortunate. I had very good teachers, so that was a big help to me.
That is very, especially back when.
Yeah, yeah.
A teacher, you know, your kid was supposed to be seen and not heard, and there wasn't much of that.
Well, no, I didn't grow up in Dickensian times. It wasn't, yes. You know, we were hunter-gatherers and, you know, no, I mean, it was a school, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is that's a much newer thought. The teacher gets involved and sees things in a student.
Well, no, not really, because the late 60s was when all that was starting.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember Mrs. Hawks had a whole class on Frank Zappa.
Oh, boy.
And talking about these lyrics and songs. What do you kids think of, you know, and having discussions. So it was fairly progressive then.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, this is the beginning of that movement.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's sort of when it started.
What you would have probably stumbled onto that on your own in pretty short time being a comedian.
Well, probably. I might have, but who knows? You never know where, you know. I'm a great believer in just – pick a road, because it'll just, as long as it takes you somewhere. And everything that I have or I get, it seems to be because I did something else. I chose to try something different or something new. And it usually leads to something positive, you know?
Yeah, I think you get up and you just go to work and you get busy and things start to happen.
Right.
As opposed, I think people, especially in this town, spend way too much time plotting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Versus just doing, and things magically have a way of working out or opening up when you're just moving forward.
Yeah, I see this with comics all the time. They're more interested in impressing the other comedians. Like I meet comedians, I'll say, every time I go to the Improv, the Comedy Store, I do a different show every night. Yeah, but you get no laughs. I mean, it's a matter of just do the stuff that works. You know, you tape your 20-minute set, listen to it, and realize – you only have 4 minutes of really funny stuff. So just do the 4 minutes and then add 10 or 15 seconds on a week or whatever it takes until you can build the whole thing up. But I always meet people that are so impressed about – they're so trying to impress the other comics in the room that they wind up losing the audience. You know?
Yeah, there is a little bit of a trap being the comedian's comedian, because it, in a way, sometimes it means you're not the audience's comedian.
That's right. You wind up being – not the famous guy. You know who Joe Ancis was?
No.
Joe Ancis was a muse. He was a muse for Lenny Bruce. He was a muse for Rodney Dangerfield. He was what we used to call a table comic. You would go to the in L.A. at the time, it was Cantor's or Nate Now's Deli, and comedians sit around late at night. And Joe Ancis was a guy who would tell the funniest stories and have funny little analogies and phrases. And Joe, can I have that? Man, I love that. Joe, can I have that? So Lenny got a lot of his personality. And Rodney to a certain extent too. You know, I knew Rodney before the No Respect.
Uh-huh.
He was just a comic. And he used to do bits. I remember one he had that was pretty funny about I was your pilot, Captain so-and-so. We're flying over with so-and-so. If you look out of the left side of the plane, you can see the remnants of Flight 118 that crashed and killed almost everyone on board. Bob, you were with me on that one, weren't you? You know, I remember that was one of the – he used to have those guys, but he would set up like a – you know, like a play and just act the whole thing out.
Yeah, kind of Newhart-y,
and
maybe.
And then I don't know whether the No Respect thing came from Joe, and I have no idea. Maybe not, but he was that kind of guy who would give you an influence, you know. When I hang out with you or I hang out with that comic, there's a phraseology or something, you're like, oh, boy, that's good. I like that. I love it. What if Adam is doing that, you know, whatever it might be. But you listen to other people, you listen to them talk, and you pick up their rhythm, you know. To get back to what you're saying, a lot of comics become Joe Ancis. They're just not funny enough for the audience. They're funny for the comics, you know.
Yeah, the way my Joanne's story would be, sometimes if people come up to me, and they probably do the same to you too, once you know you're a comedian, you know, and they go, who's the funniest guy you know? And they want you to say some name that right. they recognize. And right. I always go, the funniest guy I know you've never heard of.
Right.
He was Joe Ancis.
Right, right.
I haven't heard of him.
Right.
I roll pretty deep with comedians, but right. I don't know who Joe Ancis yeah. is, and you're not going to know who my guy
right.
is either. He does crack up all the comedians. He does hold court. He does do all that, but he's so ensconced in that, he forgot right. about the audience.
And Joe was long before your time. I'm not much older than you, so I'm another generation, and Joe was a generation before me. You know what's so funny? You watch comics now and everybody complains.
Do you know what became of him?
Well, I mean, I know he died a long time ago. He was not a kid. I don't know what he died of. I mean, probably.
Well, did he make money in the business?
I don't think so.
Really?
I don't think so.
Wow.
But, you know, it's so funny when I hear comics talk about cancel culture and people don't realize. Do you know what a cabaret card is?
Hmm.
In New York yeah. City, if you were a stand-up comedian, you got a cabaret card,
mm-hmm.
which was a license to stand on stage and perform.
Yeah, sort of like and a Lenny, cab medallion
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, well, Lenny Bruce had a cabaret card, and he'd sit on stage, and he started doing interracial jokes and using four-letter words. And what Lenny is famous for, and a policeman went up on the demanded his cabaret, tore it up, that's it, you're not working anymore. And he couldn't work.
That's canceled.
He had to go to court.
Right.
And eventually, then of course, you had a new Supreme Court coming in the late 60s. And then suddenly pornography, everything was out the window. Everything was over. But yeah, it used to be you got arrested.
Right.
You got arrested for being gay.
Right.
If you were gay, that was a crime. If you used four-letter words on stage. I remember Abbie Hoffman came to the Boston Common to speak at the height of all of Vietnam and everything, and he used the F word through the microphone, which had never been done. It might have been done, but certainly not to this extent. And on the Boston Common with the microphones for 20,000 people, you know, and the cops went up and he got arrested, you know.
Yeah.
I remember walking down the street. I went near the Paramount Steakhouse on Charles Street in Boston, and an interracial couple, black guy, white girl, come my way. A cop stops him and goes to the black guy, you walk that way? To the white girl, you walk that way. I see you two together. I'm arresting you. You understand? And, of course, they split and hook up.
That's Boston 2017. I got news for you.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah, it was a different time.
Yeah, with real consequences.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Now we talk about, you know, microaggressions and stuff like that. But these were overt aggressions.
Yeah, that's ow, hitting the head aggression. Yeah. I met my friend Amos Tucker. We were on the same thing. We're on our way to go hear Abbie Hoffman speak. Cop goes, hey, hold on. Where you going? And we go, and I said, we're just going for a walk, officer. And Amos, we're going to go see Abbie Hoffman talk about the. And I said, the cop, oh, yeah, that's what you think you'll do? Yeah. And he raises his nightstick. And Amos says, first of all, you can't hit me with that stick. Because of the Constitution, blah, this cop just beat the crap out of him. I go, Amos, I think, okay, thank you, officer. It's fine. Thank you. I'll get him home. And just beat the crap out of him with this nightstick. And I go, what are you doing? What do you mean he can't? What do you,
Well, it's interesting because you are very liberal in many ways, very progressive in other ways, and then very American and very.
Well, I'm not agreeing with that. I'm just saying what it is. I'm not condoning it.
No,
heavens.
No, I'm not accusing you of condoning that. What I'm saying is I don't know that people can figure you out. A lot of people, you know, wear their politics on their sleeve. A lot of people go, that guy's in that camp and she's over in that camp. But you're very libertarian, I guess. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I mean, you attended these things. You come from a progressive era. You were the recipient of good teaching and stuff like that.
Yeah, my brother went to military school.
Right. On the other hand, there's that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd see nothing, you know. I like the armed forces. I like the cops. I do benefits for, you know. It's hard to pin. Now everybody labels you one thing or the other, you know. for example, if you own a gun, well, you're also homophobic and racist. Well, that's not necessarily so.
Right. So you can't sort of be pro-police and pro-military and pro-gay marriage in this new world order we're living in.
Well, I mean, obviously you can be, but it's just people look at you askance if you...
Well, I mean, you can be, but what I'm saying is we have to compartmentalize you into something convenient, and that's
right.
What ends up happening.
That sounds fine.
So, and I think for you, you probably don't push politics out there because...
I stopped doing politics on my act last year. I'm doing this game show about your life, you know, and I sold it on the premise of there's no politics. We don't discuss politics at all. And I see people come on who I know I'm not going to agree with that guy.
Right.
But since it never comes up, I realize he's a plumber. He's got four kids. He's happily married, goes to church, lives a decent life. Okay, we just disagree on this one issue and let's not discuss it, you know. But I found trouble with doing politics is you say, today President Biden, and then the audience is waiting. Is this pro-Biden or anti-Biden? And they wait to the punchline before they decide if they're going to laugh, which – ruins the whole premise of it. I mean, just ruins the whole idea of the comedy is just that element of surprise of what the joke is, you know? So I just took those jokes out. You know, I use Rodney as my model. I said to myself one day, you know, I've known Rodney Dangerfield for 40 years. I have no idea who he voted for, what he thinks about any of the issues, because we just discussed jokes.
Right.
Just talk. Is this funny? You think this? Is this stupid? Is this too stupid? You know, and that's really what it was. And I realized, Rodney used every possible drug you could imagine. And I don't do any. But we hit it off great because all we talked about were jokes.
You know? You won't even take an aspirin after you've been set on fire.
No, I didn't take any. Well, that really doesn't do anything actually if you're on fire.
I'm just saying, in contrast to Rodney's personal drug in. Consumption.
Like to say laughter is the best medicine. Actually, it's terrible medicine. It doesn't do anything at all.
No, but the hyperbolic chamber, or hyperbaric, I should say.
Hyperbaric. Yeah, that works pretty good. That works pretty good. But you can only stay in it so many hours.
Do you find, speaking of you and the big outpouring, so, you know, when you were in the hospital
mm-hmm. –
everybody from all sides of the aisle and all over America and beyond all just reached out. Jay is an American treasure. It's basically that.
All right.
You're a modest guy, but that was basically the outpouring that I experienced watching all the news programs and things of that nature. Do you feel like since you stopped doing the Tonight Show that you've had a bit of a renaissance, but like people look at you in a different way now, more as a pure comedian?
I think so. Yeah, I do sense that. I try not to, you know, I try not to believe the good stuff or the bad stuff. I mean, I meet comedians all the time. I go, okay, did you see what they said about me in the paper? Oh, my God. And I go, nobody cares. Okay? And nobody cares. I mean, how can you treasure the good stuff? And it's all the same. It's all the same. It's very nice if they say nice things. But if they don't, it's not the end of the world. You know, I rationalize. How many people think read the newspaper? How many people think saw your article? They didn't, you know. My favorite thing is when I see people on Jerry Springer. I'm coming on national television to tell everyone, like all of America, oh, my God, honey, come in here. It's this guy from Springfield, Missouri, and he's talking about, you know, it just makes me laugh that people think anybody cares.
Well, is it that I've said this before to you, and I always want to be clear. It's not low self-esteem or no self-esteem. It's a sort of a non-relationship with self-esteem. Like, you might be confused if I said so-and-so was talking about you. You might say, why were they talking about me?
Now, I say I'm a huge believer in low self-esteem because it's the key to success.
Yes.
You know, you don't – if you listen, you know, like most people can't do anything. And some people can do one thing. I can do one thing and did pretty good. But I can't spell. I'm terrible at math or whatever. So – when I did the Tonight Show, I hired the best people I could, and I said, you guys run stuff. Just tell me when I suck. Please don't lie to me. Okay. And they would go, yeah, you suck tonight. It was bad. Okay, let's make changes, whatever. And we had the same crew and the same – you know, I always tell – we had 64 children born on the Tonight Show. Our staff all intermarried each other.
That was the one blues singer who was in the band, but I get what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
I was just making a joke about a blues singer.
Yeah. And so it was just kind of fun. Everybody knew their job and they did it, and that was my thing. Just stand back and they know more than the lighting guy knows more than you do.
So do you feel like America feels different about Jay Leno post The Tonight Show than they did during The Tonight Show?
No, I think it's a cumulative effect. You try to live your life a certain way, and you try to do – the one thing I have noticed is I get a lot of – my mom broke down in 1984, and this guy who I later found out was a comedian stopped and changed her tire. I get a lot – I hear those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I like
Tim
that.
Allen.
Huh?
Tim Allen?
Yeah, yeah. I get a lot of that.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, if you do those kind of things, it does come back to you. I do believe in karma. I do believe it comes round again, you know? I mean, every good work you do, it's like 6 degrees of separation. It'll affect somebody, you know?
Well, I couch it this way, which and you can agree or disagree, but I know people that are very generous and they do a lot for people. I'll include you in that group. Jimmy Kimmel's a guy, including that group. He's very generous with his time, very generous with his money, but he's always been generous with his time. When I met him, I was nobody. He was very generous with his time. And I go, the guys I know who are the most generous and give the most away and have the most time seem to be doing the best. They seem to have.
I think that's fair to say.
And I don't want to turn it into a monetary thing, but if you do want to go down that road, they happen to be doing better monetarily than many of the guys that went to high school with who always want to know what's in it for me.
Right.
And I'm not going to do this unless I get paid.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Sure.
So you can call it karma or you can just call it relationships, you know, and karma,
it just seems like common sense.
It does, but it goes against a lot of people who say, I don't want to do this thing unless I benefit directly and immediately from it.
Well, there are some people like that, but you realize you are benefiting from it. When I was doing The Tonight Show, I mean, there was a point I was making $30 million a year. It was like crazy. Okay, and that's a lot. Of course, that's a lot of money. And then The Tonight Show, things started to happen. Networks isn't doing what it was. And they said they're going to fire half the staff. I said, "Well, I said, how much money are you talking about?" They said, "About $15 million." I said, "Cut my salary in half. Believe me, it's just my wife and I. We can live on $15 million. Please, it's not the end of the world." And they said, "Do you want to do that?" I said, "Well, let's see what happens." And we kept everybody on. We had the best crew. I mean, it was great. I didn't have sandbags falling on my head. You know, how many times you've been on a show and you meet people and go, you know, I don't care if I get fired as long as that guy loses his job. I see such anger all the time. People get worked to death and something.
Well, I mean, the show, the venue, it takes on the personality of the host, just like the apartment takes on the smell of the people that are living in it.
You
open the door and you go, somebody's a cigar smoker here. Yeah. And someone likes cooking bacon. And you can tell when I would walk onto the Tonight Show set, everybody was relaxed. It was all the same faces year in and year out. There wasn't a sense of fear or panic.
Right.
And so I knew that was a sort of top-down, trickle-down thing from you.
Yeah.
So I always understood that.
Yeah, and that worked great. It's amazing how well that works.
Yeah, I concur. All right, let me hit a quick spot, and then we'll
All right, I'll wait here.
Keep going. You wait there. Well, let me tell you about Snap-on. Today's episode is brought to you by the makers and fixers of Snap-on. Yeah. I would say I'm a fixer, probably not a maker, maybe a maker of mirth, but a fixer. God, I've used my Snap-on tools and fixed so many cars and so many things around the house. Oh, they just feel better in your hand. Makers and fixers keep the world moving. You find them in factories, repair shops, roads and rails, buildings and maintenance and everywhere else. Makers and fixers are the backbone of automotive, aviation, agriculture, mining, marine, and military, And I got to tell you, it's so much better to do it yourself and to feel that tool in your hand and know it's the best with Snap-on. I know some makers and fixers. I'm a fixer. I got a guy named Sean. He works with me. He's a maker and a fixer, and we only use Snap-on. Makers and fixers, not just a job. It's a calling. They want to hear from you. Share your story at makersandfixers.com/carcast and check out the Makers and Fixers on Instagram. I'm interested in this conversation and your candor, Jay. I appreciate you coming in here. And I guess is for you, are you starting to open up more as you get older, or have you always been wired this way? If I interviewed you when you were 40, would it have been a different experience?
I don't think it would have been a lot different, no. I think I've always been pretty much the same. I mean, obviously you change, you don't realize it, but you know, it's something. I remember there was some rock star, I don't know who it is, who was a very progressive person now, and somebody ran, he was English, and somebody had a video of him at some sort of riot that was on the news at the time, just yelling racial slur, and this guy watched and he goes, "That's me, but I never said, I had no..." Apparently he had changed completely, but because he was 19 and, you know, from a poor part of London and, you know, everything was everybody else's fault. And it was just fascinating. So I'm sure. So I don't know whether I would have changed or not. It's not a question I should answer. Somebody else should probably answer it. But I don't think I would be. I think I'm pretty much the same. I've had the same sort of, you know, the great thing about doing the Tonight Show is I could observe show business without being in it. You know, I love Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen's a friend of mine. I don't want to be Charlie Sheen, but I enjoy Charlie's antics, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, my favorite one, one time we have Charlie Sheen booked on the show. I get a phone call with Donald Rehearsal. Jay, it's Debbie goes, "It's Charlie Sheen. He's on the phone." "What? Charlie, you're Jay, man, I was in the limo. We got T-boned." I said, "You okay?" "Yeah, I'm the 101. We got T-boned." I said, "I'm okay. I can't make it." "No, go home, man. Take care of yourself. I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad you're okay. Great. Okay, good." I said, "Well, find somebody else." "Okay." So I said, "Turn on the news. See anything about Charlie's accident?" You know, nothing on. So I said, "Give me." So I dial. "Give me the number of the limo guy." "Hey, hello. Hey, it's Jay Leno." "Hey, Jay." I said, "Where are you?" "I'm out front of Charlie's house waiting for him to come out." "No, he hasn't come out yet?" "No." "You didn't get T-boned on the 101? He goes, "What are you talking about?" "Stupid Charlie." So the next time I see him, I go, "What are you doing? Did you really think you're going to get away?" It's like a kid going, "There's a monster under the bed." You know, right. It's the most ridiculous lie that anybody could check at any time. And it just made me laugh. I just thought that was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen.
Now, a lot of hosts would have been pissed off and said he can't come on for the next year or whatever.
But isn't that funny? I mean, just the idea that I got T-boned, the limo burst into flames, it's on the 101s, cars are everywhere. You'd think, this would be the story of the century. All they had to do was say, "I'm sick, I have a cold." "Oh, okay." But just at the fact, this elaborate T-boned limo story, like a child. It just made me laugh. It was very funny.
What'd you drive here today?
I drove a 1959 Fiat 1100 Milecento. 10,000 original miles, original paint. Nice old girl. A lady bought it in 2006. She bought it in 1959. In 61, she put it in her living room in Pennsylvania, and she kept it there until she died. We pulled it out in 2005, and I got it.
Is much of your appreciation for cars is the story, right?
Oh, yeah, I got to have the story. That's the best part.
Because, you know, I'm always trying to think, like, oh, there's a lot of guys are Porsche guys, and then a lot of guys become Mopar guys. Yeah. And the problem with a lot of car guys is they pick a lane, pardon the pun, and then they become a little less interesting because they go, "I'm a car guy. Oh, you're a car guy." And then you start talking to them, and they're just Mopar guys. Right, and then all of a sudden they become sort of boring to me because they're essentially like saying it's like they say, "I love comedy." And then you go, "Oh, good. I love comedy. Let's talk." And they go, "Just prop comics." Oh, right. And now you're really limited to what you can talk about.
I got a friend like that. I had a Hemi Coronet. 66. He goes, let me, he looks at the blog. Oh, this was made May 2nd, 1965. Right. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, great. I said, let me show you Duesenberg. What's that? You know, Duesenberg?
Right.
No. The German? No, no, it's American. It was the most powerful American. I mean, a car that any car enthusiast would certainly know. But no, all he knew was he was a Hemi guy.
That right. And I've run into that frustration a lot because you start talking to them about they're a car guy and you go, I got this 510 and Pete Brock worked on it. And they go, I don't know who Pete Brock is and I don't know what a 510 is. Right, and yeah. You're like, I thought you were a car guy. No, I'm a Hemi guy, you know.
Right, right, right.
So it gets a little confusing. There's a motorcycle version, which is the Harley guys.
Right, Harley.
Just Harley. That's all they know, and you can't talk to them about anything else. Right. And there's so much more. But every time I think of you, you're essentially the only car guy I know who's kind of a non-category, all the way across the board car guy.
Yeah.
And I realize you're more about the story than the car, and that's why you have no category, because there's no category for a story. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's like, I don't want a story and a Hemi. I'll just take a story in any car.
But sometimes it is a story, you know. So, essentially, that's true. You're correct.
And when you – and we're talking in Malibu about an old Jag that had been – You like the buried in a garage for 40 years stories, right?
Right, right. Those are my favorite.
And I think I saw – what was the one you pulled out of Burbank next to the bookstore that was
tucked away in there? Oh, that was a 1927 Duesenberg.
That was a Duesenberg,
that was the
right?
last Duesenberg built by the Duesenberg brothers before E.L. Cord bought it and said, I want you to build the biggest, fastest, most powerful American car. And they built the Duesenberg J, the one that made their name.
Mm-hmm.
But the Duesenberg brothers were engineers. They weren't stylists. So their cars were a bit frumpy.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a lot of style. So they didn't sell many of them. But engineering-wise, they were race car guys. They won Indy a bunch of times. So when E.L. Cord came in, said, oh, that's when everything changed. And this guy had bought the last – it was called the Model X. It was the last Duesenberg built by the Duesenberg brothers before they – built the Model J. And he bought it in Chicago in 1946, had it shipped to L.A., had it towed to his garage, put it in the garage, locked the garage, some minor earthquake, the garage shifted, and
the car couldn't get the door open, right?
The car was sealed for the next, well, I took it out in 2005.
And in fact, purchased from the daughter he had passed?
Yeah, the daughter had no idea it was in the garage, but she had never been in the garage. The dad was that much of a hoarder. And I used to drive by. That's not the car, by the way. Oh, is that it?
We're looking at a picture.
Oh, yeah, that is the car. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's the one. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's it. That's
and
it.
You leave the patina on most of these cars.
That one I did. I just did the engine. I did the transmission and the brakes. And it was too nice to restore. So I just kept it original. Because you could spend $1 million restoring it wouldn't drive any better than it does now because the engine and everything has been
and it's never going to have that patina again if you
right,
restore
exactly,
it.
Right, exactly.
And so you drove – now, see, I think most people would think it was sort of risky to drive around a miniature little 1959 Fiat here in Los Angeles. It's just smaller, no airbags, no crumple zones.
That's the car. Yeah, that's my baby. Yeah, right
that
there.
That kind of stuff. But also, I feel like they think it would break down a bit going up the 405 and overheat.
You know, I broke down twice this week in my Mercedes 600. I was on the 210, and I'm driving along, and all of a sudden the front tire, boom! I mean, like a shotgun. And the tires were starting to get dry rotted, and it just blew off the rim. I mean, nothing left. Pull over, oh boy. I open my, look at that. I got a spare. I got the jack. I got everything. I put the original to spare, which is old as the car. It's mid-60s. I put the spare on. I said something, you know, I'm going to drive home. I don't want to take a chance. What if I got another flat? I go 5 miles, bam, another tire. Pulls up, I go, okay, these tires are like aging out within seconds of each other. And then I had the flatbed at home again. Then I get it home. Okay, I put 4 new tires on it. Perfect. And I'm going up Coldwater, sprag in the clutch. It just chews itself up. Okay, now I can't go forward or backward. So that's where I am right now.
Yeah, a lot of people don't have that kind of dedication to drive something different every
day. Well, I like the challenge. I like the – see, my cars, people aren't amazed that I got there quickly. They're amazed that I got there at all.
Yes.
I'm just saying, you came in that? You know, that's my favorite thing about show business, because the more successful you are, the more mentally incompetent people think you are. Like when you – like you've done this. You go to a show and they go, oh, Jay, how'd you get here? I drove myself. You what?
Yeah.
Jay drove himself. Susan, come here. Jay, where'd you park? I parked in the lot. You parked your own car? Bob, Jay parked his own car. You're kidding. No, he did. You parked your own car. And they're astounded that you can perform simple tasks. I mean, it's...
Yeah, a comedian is one of those things that I ran into it a lot, because a lot of people who used to say, you know, they'd interview me and they go, well, what was your break? How'd you get into show business? And I would say, oh, I was a boxing instructor and I taught Jimmy Kimmel. And they'd go, yeah, okay, all right, okay. And I'd go, no, that was my job. And that's how I met Jimmy, for a radio stunt. And then, or I'd say, I used to be a carpenter. And they'd go, well, who did your kitchen or whatever? And I go, I did my kitchen. And they'd go, okay, get the hell out of here. Because as a comedian, you're rendered useless. Other anywhere else but on stage telling jokes. And we don't, you know, if a fireman says, I built my own thing, or I fixed my own car, or I was a boxing coach or something, everyone goes, oh, good for you, got another job. Right. You know, comedians, we get laughed not with. But you are, I would say, you're not going to say, but I will say that you are more knowledgeable about cars and car history than about anyone on the planet, simply because most people, as we referred to earlier, sort of pick a lane and they become experts in Cadillacs or brass era cars or German cars or something. And you could never know as much. Like when I was a carpenter, I could never be as good a framer as a guy who just framed houses, because I did finish work and swung doors and tile work, and you'll never be able to outdo the guy who's dedicated to one thing 24/7. But I'd say width and breadth of car knowledge, I don't know anyone who I'd put ahead of you in any trivia competition.
Well, you probably got to get out more, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. I guess that's good. Thanks.
I would take it. So no hesitation, back to the white 1909 steamer.
Oh, yeah.
No, any thought about, I don't know, maybe I'll wear goggles when I climb under the car?
Yeah, I should do that. I do that sometimes. I just didn't do it this time. But yeah, sometimes I do that.
And maybe a shield or some gloves or something like that.
Well, you know what's interesting? You tell me, this sounds like something that's right up your alley. And this is something I've noticed, and I'm sure you have an opinion on this. I get a lot of guys come to the garage with their kids. And usually boys 6 to 9, Lamborghinis, don't see cars. And I've noticed in the last decade, maybe a little bit less, the kids come in and I go, hey, do you want to sit in it? No, it's okay.
Oh,
you sure? No, it's all right. And they're scared of their own shadows. I'm not saying kids should be crazy, but I just remember kids being up, Billy, get off, get away, get away from there. And,
right.
You know, running over to kids, especially boys being very rambunctious and whatnot. And I see this sort of, I mean, to have an 8-year-old go, isn't that kind of dangerous?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not running. You're going to sit in it. You can't. No, that's okay.
Well, I have many thoughts.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I was speaking about it last night, and I definitely want to hear your thoughts. When I was at the Malibu Country Mart, when I was leaving, I saw that Jay took a young man, I had to be a 6-7-year-old kid, and sat it in your McLaren. I hope that was your McLaren.
Yeah, my P1. Yeah.
So I was like, Jay just popped the door of a McLaren to put some kid in it. But you're telling him, grab the steering wheel and blah, blah, blah. And I just had this recovered memory of what you're talking about post about the last 10 or pre the last 10 years is kids would jump into every car, grab the steering wheel and start shaking it back and forth, even if the car, you know, wasn't running, as if they're being chased by the cops, right, and they're right. Bonnie and Clyde, and they're going, and right. they were simulating right, driving right. as best they could.
Right.
Smash cut to now, and the kid's scared to open the door and has right. to be coaxed into the cabin.
Right, right.
So something has happened. You're right. They were not only rambunctious, you had to yell at them to get out of the car. Not you, but the dad would.
Right, right.
And stop sawing away at the steering wheel. I was talking about this last night. I'm trying to figure this phenomenon out. I have nephews. I have three nephews. I had one of them stay with me about 8 or 10 years ago. He was 16 or 17. And I was like... Do you have your driver's license? He said, I said, do you want a driver's license? I'm thinking about it, but I'm not that interested. I said, well, let me take you out driving. Let me show you how to drive. I was like, I don't think that'd be a good idea. Now, you could imagine getting hold of a 17-year-old Jay Leno, handing him a brand new Audi A7, telling him, let's go tear it up a little bit, and you waving that off. I have a 16-and-a-half-year-old son, same thing, doesn't have his license. I keep telling him, like, we got to get you signed up for this. Why do we have to? I've been talking to other parents who have teenage boys especially, not interested. And it's confounding to all us old farts because, like, all I wanted when I was 15 and a half, I was counting the days.
But it's funny because I remember my dad. My dad was not a car guy. But my dad would be, the car, you get a car with an automatic trunk. What do you want to shift for? It's got an automatic. It shifts it by itself. You know, my dad could never understand why an old car would cost more than a new car.
Right.
Anytime I would buy something, dad would go, you get a new Cadillac for that. What are you doing? You
right.
know, he just never got it. So it's cyclical. Skips a generation.
Because there is something in the zeitgeist where young males especially are not dying to drive.
Well, the only thing the fear of God has been put into them over everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wearing a helmet to walk upstairs.
Right.
You know, this kind of stuff. I'm not saying that those things aren't good. I mean, yeah, it's important. You should wear a helmet when you ride a bike. But it seems like you should have to twist their arm a little bit to get them to do it. You know
yes.
what I mean? I mean, I had the Italian uncle syndrome, you know. Hey, don't do that. Hey, Jay, come here. It's $5. Don't tell your mother. Okay. You know, right. they always had that kind of – you know, it's funny because I remember as a kid, and I don't know if this is sexist or not. I don't think it is. But my dad would say, listen, I got to go out of town. You're going to be the man of the house, okay? I need you to take care of your mother and make sure that – yes, Dad, okay. You know, I was like 9 or 10. Make sure the doors are locked. Make sure everything is done because – who I was the protector. And I'm sure if I had a sister, he would have said the same thing. My mom would have said the same thing to her. So I think it was ego. But it's just a matter of making kids feel as if they are special. You know, like when I was a kid, I would go, Dad, why do I have to put a tie on to go out to dinner? Because we're Italian. Okay, that's what we do.
Right.
So everybody else that got T-shirts with obscenities written on them.
Right.
And I'm in a little jacket and tie, you know, eating meatballs and spaghetti, you know. And I said, why do I have to wear a tie? Because we're Italian, you know. So it always made me think Italians were special. We weren't, but it made me – it gave me a certain pride, you know. And I thought, okay, maybe – I guess that's a good thing. I don't know.
I got news for you, Jay. We are special.
That's right.
The paisans. Right. And, yeah, another topic for another day. But I do agree that – safety is fine, but living in fear isn't, and it has its repercussions.
Right,
and
right.
And some of those chickens are coming home to roost
and
now.
There is something to taking a chance.
Oh.
I mean,
yes.
You have to take, you know, like I was never a good athlete. I was in sports and there was, Jay, you suck. You're not a fool. Okay. Now every kid gets a trophy and everybody's the same and don't keep
right.
score. And
yes.
It's not if you win the game. It's if you win the game. That's what it is.
Yeah. There's – not everything that is safe is good and or healthy, and it has its repercussions and sort of downstream effects that you should factor in. And I always said that I played Pop Warner football. I played football from the time I was 7 times. I got so much out of it. And everyone is so worried about injuries now. And I would say breaking a forearm, that'll take 6 months to heal, but being a pussy is a lifetime sentence, right. And that's what we're working on now.
I remember I'd say something, and the mother would say, don't do that. I'd go, well, listen to your mother. Your mother knows better. But at least the kid knows, it's hard to put into words what I'm saying, I guess. It's just the idea that I just remember the grown-ups would give you a wink. You know, like my uncles would go, hey, Jay, don't do that. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think I can sum it up by saying if you grew up in this modern zeitgeist, especially here in Los Angeles, I don't think Jay Leno would be the Jay Leno that we know today.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
I'm saying yes, or you definitely would have been wearing goggles when you're underneath that.
That's probably true.
That steam car. All right, Jay Leno, Jay Leno's Garage, of course, on YouTube. I never miss an episode, and you can shoot him a tweet at Jay Leno as well. And the car care products, can we give a plug? Are they out
and
about?
Yeah, they're doing really well. We're in Walmart. We're on our own Jay Leno's Garage website. We're on Amazon. We should do about 12, 15 million this year in sales, so it's doing really well.
Couldn't happen to a better guy. I'll be at the Tucson Rialto Theater coming up December 15th. So come on out and see me. I'll be at the Tempe Improv 16th and 17th. Until next time, Sam Carolla for Lewis Howes and Jay Leno saying mahalo.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
You know, I got to tell you, I have so many garbage apps on my phone, I never know where to look for stuff. And recently, I decided to clean house. All the junk and clutter gone. This leaves me with my most cherished apps. You know, the ones that can do it all. Like my Live One app. Music, events, news, podcasts, comedy. Oh, and actual musical stations curated by humans, not those robots hanging out on Bezos' yacht. All this on one tiny little place on my phone. I've become such a fan of the app, we here at the Adam Carolla Show will give you 3 months free. Jump on to liveone.com/Carolla to lock in your deal today. And with inflation at an all-time high, this is a huge savings. liveone.com/Carolla for 3 months plus for free. No ads. Do you own? Do you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.